Welcome to Under Lock and Key, news and commentary about prisons from the Revolutionary Anti-Imperialist League and the Maoist Internationalist Movement.
A new study denounces the waiver of juveniles for prosecution in adult courts.
Remember the Attica Rebellion.
And an essay by Mamia Abu-Jamal entitled Clinton's Poverty Tour.
The U.S. incarcerates a greater percentage of its population than any other country, sending more black men to prison than college. The purpose of this program is to educate about and inspire activism against the American lockdown.
As the U.S. Congress hammers out the final wording of the youth crime bill it has considered since April, a new study released by the Justice Policy Institute denounces one of the gross practices heralded by the pending legislation: the ability of prosecutors to decide whether to try juveniles in adult or juvenile court. In most states, this power resides with the judge. In some, laws spell out which crimes get waived to adult court. But in 15 states, prosecutors can make this decision in a case-by-case basis. The Justice Policy Institute study was based on Florida, the leading state in this practice. In 1998, Florida prosecutors sent 4,660 children to adult court. In 36 states, judges make the decision. But in 1995, judges sent less than 10,000 juveniles to adult court. Florida's prosecutors transferred 7,000 in that same year. Juvenile crime rates are higher, not lower, in states that allow prosecutors to decide. And at the same time that the waivers are increasing, the number of cases going through juvenile justice system continues to soar. Florida has the sixth largest juvenile incarceration rate per 100,000. Finally, the Justice Policy Institute cites other studies showing that juveniles sent to adult prison are more likely to be arrested again than those sent to juvenile facilities. And the Justice Policy Institute concludes the policy's failure based on moral, ethical grounds. The practice disproportionately targets oppressed nation youth, with blacks 2.3 times more likely than whites to be transferred to adult court. The majority of cases transferred are for nonviolent property crimes, not the violent cases for which the practice was supposedly created. And the study reports that the suicide rate for youths is 7.7% higher when they are in adult instead of juvenile prisons. Childhood and adulthood are socially defined categories, policed in the U.S. by a patriarchal and white supremacist state. Some acts are criminal only by virtue of the age of the offender, running away, breaking a curfew, having sex. It is bad enough that this legal system decides who is and who is not a child, as in statutory rape laws. When they are considered youth, people are not permitted to control their own lives. So the law exists to control all children. When they are no longer considered youth, they are oppressed or repressed in this country based primarily on national origin. So all children are paternistically protected, which means their parents and relatives are protected from others having access to abuse them. But oppressed nation young people are more likely to be considered adults at an earlier age. They're out of the frying pan and into the fire. When prosecutors are given the authority to determine who is a child and who is an adult, the system is exposed for its vengefulness, irrationality, and national oppression. For example, in cases where the legal system allows discretion, there is usually a bias against people convicted of committing crimes against those who are most protected by the system, as in death penalties being most likely when the victims are white. While we believe that the JPI study ends up painting too rosy a picture of the juvenile justice system by comparison, it is true that by mission and orientation, the juvenile justice system claims to rehabilitate, where the adult system exists, by its own admission, only to repress. When prosecutors decide to try children as adults in court, they are deciding against even the pretense of rehabilitation, and they are empowered to make that decision based on the supposed character of the individual or his or her crime. We also report on this study to expose the ever-growing trend towards longer, harsher sentences and increased repression of youth and oppressed nations in general. In addition to pending federal law, quote, a ballot initiative which will go before California voters in March 2000 would also grant prosecutors discretion to decide whether a juvenile should be tried in adult court, end quote. Our criticisms of the criminal juvenile injustice system are thorough and across the board. No one practice, if eliminated, would rehabilitate this vicious system. But studying the specific practices can expose the system's nature. Join MIM and Rails' efforts to struggle against the injustice system.
Remember the Attica Rebellion. This is a statement from the Maoist internationalist movement released on the 28th anniversary of the Attica Prison Rebellion. September 9th marks the 28th anniversary of the Attica Prisoners' Rebellion against both inhumane conditions within the New York State prison system and against the repression of political struggle throughout America. The rebellion occurred in the context of increasing anti-imperialist organizing and brought America's attention to the needs of prisoners. The struggle at Attica Prison in upstate New York also led radicals outside America's gulags to examine the treatment of prisoners within the anti-imperialist movement. In remembering Attica, MIM honors the masses murdered by America. We take this opportunity to build upon historical, revolutionary lessons and to continue the struggle against American imperialism and its internal domination through police occupation and the prison system. We urge prisoners to join a united struggle from within, study Maoist political economy and philosophy, and develop an historical material analysis. Such study will give prisoners the best tools to build anti-imperialist revolution toward socialism. Prisoner members of the Black Panther Party, Young Lords Party, Weathermen, and other groups organized within Attica, and some prisoners participated in Maoist study groups. Prisoners formed the Attica Liberation Front and presented a list of demands to the New York State Commissioner of Correction Services, Russell Oswald, in May 1971. The prisoners wrote, quote, "We are firm in our resolve, and we demand as human beings the dignity and justice that is due to us by our right of birth. We do not know how the present system of brutality and dehumanization and injustice has been allowed to be perpetuated in this day of enlightenment, but we are living proof of its existence, and we cannot allow it to continue." End quote. The prisoners' demands included an end to prison slave labor, freedom to be politically active, uncensored access to publications and mail, open communications with the outside world, a healthy diet, freedom to practice religion, modernized education, adequate medical attention, and genuinely rehabilitative programs within the prisons. MIM and prisoner activists continue to fight for such basic demands in America. But the idea of prisoners as human beings who deserve dignity and justice by the right of their birth, as the Attica prisoners wrote, is distasteful to imperialism. Prisons are a vital component of this stage of American capitalism. The gulags restrain independent activism of the internal semi-colonies by splitting up families and communities, and by wrecking the continuity of social life that can nourish political dissent. We must recognize the level of repression directed at would-be revolutionary groups. Organizing at this time must build foundations for revolution. We can build on the gains in education around Attica and similar movements by building independent institutions of the oppressed. Reforms within the system will be bundled up and burned by the imperialists at the next opportunity. In the wake of the Attica Rebellion, prisoners were promised nearly all of their 28 demands, except amnesty and repatriation to a third world country. In 1991, Akil El-Jundi, a prisoner injured during the Attica massacre, told MIM, quote, "In a lot of ways, prison conditions have gotten worse. What has happened is the state has had an opportunity to learn off of Attica, so they've adopted measures that are more repressive. In a lot of cases, they've given prisoners things that look like panaceas, you know, quick solution stuff, which is basically meant to keep people from starting to ask what the problems really are," end quote. During the year from August 1970 to August 1971, there were 9 rebellions and strikes at other New York State jails and prisons, beginning with the Tombs, the Metropolitan Correction Center, renamed by the prisoners in recognition of the many men killed there. Uprisings over brutal conditions and treatment spread throughout the state. At Attica, prisoners were allowed only 1 shower per week. They were allowed visits only through wire mesh, and interception and censorship of mail was the norm. In the metal shop, prisoners worked for 29 cents a day. Prisoner warehousing and conditions under the American lockdown have worsened since. Mim remembers the brothers who were murdered by the New York State troopers and vindictive prison guards on September 13, 1971, when the prison was retaken. 10 hostages and 29 prisoners were murdered in the assault by New York State troopers. The premeditated murders took place with the knowledge and explicit non-interference of Governor Nelson Rockefeller. This was the same Rockefeller who passed New York State's infamous mandatory minimum drug laws in 1973 and moved from the governorship to the U.S. vice presidential campaign. Outside observers sequestered from the yard where the massacre took place reported being incapacitated by CS nerve gas that was thrown down in the yard. The observers believed that there was no way the prisoners, the direct targets of the gas, could have been a threat to anyone. Yet the only rationale the state ever offered for shooting so many people dead was that these prisoners were aiming to hurt their hostages. Mim argues that the massacre was not necessary to the prison retaking, only to the prison's function of social control. Like the brutality of imprisonment itself, this type of retribution against protest is the state's method of deterring future organization and rebellion. Before any autopsies were done, the state announced that the prisoners had killed the hostages with spears and attempted to bury the hostages' bodies. The coroner came out with the truth about their deaths independently. The state's mercenaries also planted weapons next to the prisoners to create the myth that the prisoners were armed. Such myths served to put the finishing touches on America's justification for treating prisoners as animals. Mim has organized talks by former Attica prisoner Frank Big Black Smith. He describes how even after the massacre, Attica prisoners were tortured and threatened with mutilation and death. To get back to their cell wing, the prisoners were run between 2 rows of baton-swinging correctional officers, barefoot and naked over broken glass. National Guardsmen reported that wounded prisoners were beaten as the guards carried them to the infirmary or ambulances. In Mim's 1991 commemorative Attica coverage, a Washington prisoner wrote, quote, "To appreciate the events at Attica, it is first necessary to put them in proper political and historical context. Today, many prisoners view justice as nothing more than a cop's bullet in the back or as endless years of meaningless confinement. That's bourgeois justice. What the brothers at Attica were fighting for is proletarian justice, which is an end to the system that perpetuates the destructive cycle that imprisonment represents. They wanted us to see the rebellion as one battle in a continuous struggle waged on an international level, not just one isolated incident."
This is an essay by Mamiya Abu-Jamal entitled Clinton's Poverty Tour. With Mamiya's access to the media limited, this essay is read by the Revolutionary Anti-Imperialist League. See for yourself why the United Snakes wants to silence revolutionary leader Mamiya Abu-Jamal.
Clinton's Poverty Tour by Mamiya Abu-Jamal. As summer bakes the land, American President Clinton began his poverty tour, the first of his presidency, into the poorest pockets of American life, where American dreams sour into grim nightmares. The president of the wealthiest nation on earth visited the Appalachians, the Southern California neighborhood of Watts, and among other poor and depressed areas, the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota, home of the Oglala Sioux Nation. For most commentators, The Clinton trip was proof of his compassion for the poor, as his tour attracted intense media attention to some of the nation's poorest communities. For others, it is striking that a man who ran his first presidential campaign using the line, "I feel your pain," took almost 8 years to show that he knew such places as Pine Ridge Reservation, Watts, and the Appalachians even existed. Perhaps the pain he felt was that of the bulls and bears of Wall Street. Further, other than one day's media fascination, of what use is the attention of a lame duck president who has less than 20 months in his office left? What will he do to these depressed and ailing communities of red, black, and poor white folks to bring them up to scale? What does he propose to do that will transform the 75% unemployment among the Lakota people on Pine Ridge? In a word, nothing. His effort was little more than a White House photo op and an appeal to U.S. business to exploit the natural and human capital of the areas. But this is also the president of the NAFTA agreement, the international trade pact that opened the door to capital flight south of the border, where labor is cheap and plentiful. Would business choose labor that must be paid minimum wage, or opt for those who will accept only pennies to work? There is another reason why this A Day with the Poor tour was a travesty. The trip to Pine Ridge was made by an American president, and nary a word was said about its most famous former resident, Native American political prisoner Leonard Peltier. Were it not for his fervent supporters, who shouted from the periphery the proud name of one of the Lakota's bravest warriors, Leonard Peltier would not have been mentioned. For Clinton, the president in search of a legacy, a simple signature on a piece of paper setting Peltier free would have been an act that spoke for generations. Instead, ever the politician, he issued words and walked away, ever in search of another handshake, another crowd, and yet another photo op.
This has been Under Lock and Key, a Revolutionary Anti-Imperialist League and Maoist Internationalist Movement program about prisons. For more information, contact RAIL, P.O. Box 712, Amherst, Massachusetts, 01004, or email radio@mim.org.